I'm Jackie Leiden, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away today. Coming up, after last night's Super Bowl, the NFL season may be over, but the buzz over Super Bowl ads is still going strong. Snoozy or stirring, we'll talk winners and losers of last night's ad war and what you thought of Madonna in just a few minutes. But first, we focus on the nation's housing crisis. President Obama unveiled a proposal last week intended to kickstart a housing market that's been dragged down by foreclosures and declining home prices for years. The crux of the plan is to make it easier for homeowners locked in at higher interest rates to take advantage of today's record lows. In the same week the president's housing proposal was unveiled, NPR, in conjunction with the independent investigative newsroom ProPublica, broke a story about questionable practices by Freddie Mac, the government-owned mortgage giant. The reports reveal that Freddie had invested billions of dollars in securities that bet against homeowners' ability to refinance their loans. In other words, some investments by Freddie Mac could be more profitable if homeowners were unable to refinance their homes. Here to talk more about this is NPR's Chris Arnold, who did the investigation for NPR. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jackie.
Chris, remind us about what you and ProPublica discovered that Freddie Mac was doing and why it raised red flags all over town.
Sure. Well, I was working with Jesse Eisinger, who's a reporter for ProPublica, and we found out that Freddie Mac, which we should say guarantees mortgages like Fannie Mae does, its sister company. So Freddie and Fannie are a big part of who gets to decide, all right, you qualify for a refinance or you don't. And Freddie Mac has all sorts of criteria. You know, you have to have this kind of credit score and you can't have had a short sale or a foreclosure in your recent history and stuff like that. What we found was that at the same time that Freddie Mac was tightening those credit standards, that is making it harder to refinance, the company was also going out into the market and betting against homeowners' ability to refinance, and not just small bets. You know, we're talking about $5 billion in bets that are linked to 20, maybe up to $30 billion worth of mortgages tied to 100,000 plus homeowners. So these bets involved a lot of money and a lot of people. And really, Freddie entered into a kind of financial bet where if Jane Doe gets to refinance her loan from 7% down to 4%, Freddie Mac loses money. If she can't, Freddie Mac makes money. And we were raising the question, you know, is this inappropriate for somebody who's creating the standards to be betting against homeowners?
And you mentioned about 100,000 homeowners have been touched by this. And were most of them in good standing on their loans?
Yeah. You know, these are not people who got subprime loans or who've missed a lot of payments. These are, you know, Americans. Some of them are struggling. You know, a spouse may have lost a job and we're coming out of this recession. And we found this one family where, you know, they're very paycheck to paycheck living in Pennsylvania. And $500 a month they would save if they could refinance. And that would be a really big deal to them. But they're stuck. And a lot of people are stuck, upwards of 10 million people by some economists' estimates.
Chris, as we mentioned, this got a lot of attention. And our colleague, Steve Inskeep, the host of NPR's Morning Edition, interviewed Edward DeMarco. And he is the acting director of the oversight agency, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, which oversees both Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. And here's what he told Steve. He said he was completely puzzled that something immoral was going on. Here's a bit of that.
I think I have a responsibility to make sure Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac undertake activities that don't cause further losses to the American taxpayer. We have a responsibility to ensure that the housing finance system works efficiently and effectively, that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's role in it is to bring stability and liquidity to that market and to do so in a creditworthy manner.
Now, Chris, as you know, part of Freddie's mission is to help expand opportunities for home ownership for Americans. But many observers say the housing crisis was in part because the organization didn't pay enough attention to the need to run an effective business. So is there evidence that Freddie Mac's choice to essentially bet against refinancing for certain homeowners worked as a sort of business strategy?
Well, there's a couple of points to make there. And first, let's say right off, we found no evidence that there are people inside of Freddie Mac that were saying, aha, you know, we can make more money if we inappropriately keep homeowners from refinancing and then we make these bets. And so this is a big intentional thing that we're doing that we know is wrong. We didn't find that there wasn't a link that we were able to uncover between tightening credit for homeowners and placing these bets in the marketplace. We're just pointing out that there is a tension there, a conflict there. Should the same company really be allowed to set policy and then bet against people related to the to that policy because of the potential for that to happen? But there are a couple things too. What Mr. DeMarco is saying with part of that is, look, yes, okay, we're making money here, and it's appropriate for us to make money. We need to protect taxpayers, and we're already on the hook for billions of dollars. Freddie and Fannie have lost billions of dollars. He's been criticized, though, for having a short-term, forgive the term, sort of bean counter sort of approach to saving taxpayers' money. And there's a lot of economists who say, look, if you loosened up credit more for homeowners to allow them to refinance, in the long term, that would save taxpayers more money than if you were really tight-fisted about things.
Just pause there a moment. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about the nation's housing crisis with NPR's Chris Arnold, who helped break a story last week involving the government-owned mortgage giant Freddie Mac and its practice of betting against some of its homeowners. And joining us now with another window on the housing crisis is Arturo de los Santos. He's a former Marine who says he's tried multiple times to restructure his loan for his home in Riverside, California, but he was denied a modification of that loan. Mr. De Los Santos, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, let me say, you're in a complicated situation. You're trying to work with Freddie Mac to help modify your loan so that you can start to make payments again. You were evicted last summer. In December, you and your family decided to reoccupy your home. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, what happened in my case, I tried for loan modification. They put me on the trial payments. I made my trial payments on time. I sent my fourth trial payment. It was rejected, and I called the bank and asked them why they had rejected my money. They said my modification had been denied, and they weren't accepting any more of my money. So I asked them what I should do. They had me reapply for another loan modification. That was also denied. I had already explained to them my income had recovered, and I could make my original payments if they couldn't modify my loan. They refused to accept any more money. So the second modification did not go through. I ended up doing a third modification. So during the third loan modification, we receive a call a day before our house goes to auction. And I call JPMorgan Chase and ask them, why are you going to sell the house? And they said, well, we have two departments, a foreclosure department and a loan modification department. Our foreclosure department decided to sell the house.
Okay, so they didn't give you a chance. Chris, now, Mr. De Los Santos' issue is another facet of this crisis. How well has the Obama administration done so far in finding help for homeowners who need loan modification to stay in their homes?
Right. And this, we should say, is separate from the investigation that we were conducting about refinancings. Now we're getting into the whole realm of foreclosure prevention, and there are a lot of problems here, too. For years, there has been a program on the books from the Obama administration. It's called the Home Affordable Modification Program, or HAMP. And when we looked at this as reporters, when it first came out, this sounded really good, and the administration was saying, look, we can reach 4 million, 3 to 4 million homeowners. But there have been tons of problems. I mean, so far, less than a million people have been reached. And a big part of the problem is that where the banks interface with the homeowner here, you heard Mr. De Los Santos say that he was dealing with JPMorgan Chase. It sounds like Freddie Mac might own his loan, but JPMorgan Chase is the bank that manages his loan, and that's the bank that he sends the payments to. There are lots of different organizations involved. They all have different incentives. And there have been so many reports of homeowners faxing stuff in again and again and again. And then the bank says, we didn't get it, or, oh, we lost it, or we got to start all over again. And people get strung along for months and months and months. And not to say that every homeowner out there deserves a loan modification and has the ability to stay in their house, but there are millions who do, and they've been having no end of trouble. And okay. I think Mr. De Los Santos' case is one of those, it sounds like.
Mr. De Los Santos, the sheriff has notified you that they may come and remove you and your four children. What's going on? How do you think this is going to end for you?
Yes, on February 2nd, we had court, and the judge did sign the order to evict us. And about 2 weeks after we were evicted, we received a letter from Chase saying they were going to adjust our payments.
Okay.
You mean saying that you were going to get this loan modification?
Correct. And this goes back to where what they call dual tracking, to where two branches within the same bank aren't working together. They foreclosed on the property while the other bank, the other branch, was still working on our loan modification.
What's it like to try to communicate with Freddie Mac for you, Mr. De Los Santos?
We were able to speak with Freddie Mac, and I contacted Freddie Mac, and they said, I explained to him our situation, what had gone on with our loan, and I told him about the letter that adjusted our payment, and they said, well, you need to contact Chase about that. And they refused to give us any number to Chase. So it's really hard to communicate with the banks when you try to work with them. It's really hard to get a straight answer from them.
Chris, we started off with the Freddie Mac investigation, and it may also be a good place for us to end. Members of Congress say the incident should be investigated further. Is that happening?
Well, we've had senior members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats, firing off letters to the White House, letters to regulators saying we want to find out more about what's been going on at Freddie Mac regarding these investments. And they've gotten some information back from the regulator and Mr. DeMarco. Some of this might come up in hearings on Thursday of this week, but safe to say there is still a lot of digging going on.
NPR's Chris Arnold investigated the Freddie Mac story for NPR, and he joins us today from Boston. And Arturo De Los Santos is a former Marine who resides in Riverside, California, with his wife and four children, and he's trying to fight eviction from his home in Riverside, California, and he joined us from there. Thank you again, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jackie.
I'm Jackie Leiden, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. We'll jump into the pages of the Washington Post magazine and talk to a former football coach about using sports to find redemption. That's coming up. But first, to the Super Bowl, or actually the Super Bowl ads. Advertisers spent about $3.5 million per 30 seconds to do their best to wow viewers, and they might have gotten their money's worth. More than 100 million people tuned in. Joining me to talk about which ads scored and which fumbled are Eric Deggans. He's the TV and media critic for the Tampa Bay Times. And also with us is Makisha Madden-Toby. She's the TV critic and entertainment writer for the Detroit News. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, last night seemed to be about babies, cars, and dogs, and some really great blasts from the past.
He bought it. How can I handle work on a day like today? One of the worst performances of my career, and he never doubted it for a second. Hi, can I get my CRV brought up, please? I've got a lot to do today.
Broderick. Broderick.
Of course, that was Matthew Broderick. He was the star of the 1986 movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which this ad was playing off of course. But it wasn't a surprise to a lot of people because about half of the Super Bowl ads this year were released on YouTube a few days early. Makisha Madden-Toby, why did advertisers do this?
I think to create buzz, but in a way it sort of made everything anticlimactic. It just felt, I don't know, part of the fun of seeing Super Bowl ads is being surprised by what you see. And there was no element of surprise if you saw it online. And that takes away some from the experience, I think.
Does it make the ads less effective, in your opinion?
I think they're just as effective. It's just they're not as much fun, actually. And maybe in that way, I guess they aren't as effective if you look at it like that. If part of the fun is watching Super Bowl ads and people anticipating what they're going to see, and you take away some of the anticipation, I don't know if you remember the ad more. You do remember the product, but in that way they get their desired result. But in terms of what people are talking about, people were already talking about Matthew Broderick all last week. They're not going to be talking about him tomorrow again unless they talk about how much they didn't like it or how much it wasn't as good maybe the second time around.
Yeah, I would point out that I think they did it because the Volkswagen ad from last year featuring the kid who was dressed like Darth Vader was so popular. That ad was released early, and it became a viral hit even after the Super Bowl. But TiVo, the company that makes a digital video recorder that a lot of people use, released its figures on Super Bowl ads, and the most engaged ads, the ads that people watched the most, were the ones that were not released early. So I think they did pay a price this time.
Interesting. Well, Doritos ads are usually real crowd pleasers, and this year wasn't any different. I'd play a clip, but it's a lot of silence. It's more about what wasn't said. And so, Eric, you said that this was one of your favorite ads at the Tampa Bay Times. Tell listeners about the Great Dane spot for those who didn't see it.
Sure. This is a great Dorito. Doritos had a bunch of great ads in the Super Bowl, but this was the best one. This is a guy messing around in his yard. He notices a dog that seems to be covering up a collar that might have belonged to an animal. And then he looks up and he sees a poster that shows that it's the collar that belongs to a cat that's been missing. And the dog comes over and looks him in the face and gives him a bag of Doritos with a little note that says, "You didn't see nothing." And then the end of the ad, this guy's presumably his wife is asking about the cat. And the dog is outside his patio with another bag of Doritos waiting to bribe him again. And, it's funny on one level. It was TiVo's most popular, most engaged ad as well. And a lot of people have been talking about it today. But it also sort of, I think, reveals one trend that we saw in Super Bowl ads. A lot of them were dark. A lot of them had dark undertones. It's funny on one level, but on another level, it's funny because this dog killed a cat. So, there's some other ads. There's an ad that evoked the apocalypse. There was an ad where a bunch of vampires got eliminated. There's an ad where a kid was in a pool and it's implied that he may have relieved himself in it. There were a lot of ads that pushed the boundaries of a sort of dark humor this time around.
That's interesting. I hadn't really thought about it that way, but when you add them all up, you're absolutely right. I guess all that football action kind of got in the way. What do you think, Makisha? Do you agree that there was sort of a dark, edgy undertone?
I didn't look at it as dark and edgy. Maybe I'm too dark and edgy or something. I don't know. But I really...
And it's this normal for you.
I know. I'm sitting here listening to him, and I'm like, oh, I like that one, too. Yeah, I like that one. I love the Audi ad with the vampires. I love the apocalyptic commercial because Chevy takes a dig at Ford. I think I was more focused on that. And I also was more focused on those ads because... Interestingly enough, two things happened in terms of trends with those ads that Eric mentioned that happened to have dark undertones, with the exception, of course, of the Doritos ad. But the Audi ad with the vampires, the ad with the apocalypse with the Chevy, both are auto ads. And I felt like the automakers had a better selection and better offering of ads this year than the other companies, because they didn't use celebrities or dogs.
I would say that one of the most effective ads was from an automaker, and it did feature a celebrity. It was Clint Eastwood's ad for Chrysler and Dodge, where we hear his rough-edged voice sort of delivering this speech that is sort of perking up America. It's basically sort of a classic motivational speech that you might hear at halftime. And he says, it's halftime in America. And you got to pay attention because, Dirty Harry's telling you this, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
A very dark landscape. We see a Detroit that is obviously on the ropes, but coming back.
Eric, let's just throw to that for a
sure,
moment. We'll
sure.
throw to the clip.
Let's hear a little bit of that.
This country can't be knocked out with one punch. We get right back up again, and when we do, the world's going to hear the roar of our engines. Yeah, it's halftime, America. And our second half's about to begin.
Now, I think the buzz is that was one of the most effective ads of the whole game.
Now, you just knew he was going to say, make my day right after that. Right? but what I and he did mix his metaphor, but who cares because it's Dirty Harry, right? But what's great about that, too, is that it's also a callback to a very effective ad from last year in which Eminem was driving through Detroit and his hit Lose Yourself was playing in the background. So a shout out to an earlier ad, a little bit of a dark metaphor. It also felt a little bit like a political speech in a way.
I was going to ask you. I mean, I know you guys are, entertainment TV, but a lot of people are saying that it seemed like an Obama campaign ad.
If I was Obama, I would take the soundtrack from that ad and it would be my next campaign commercial.
Well, and I loved how he said, and it's not about, we shouldn't get divided by these types of things. And then they show the White House. And I don't know. I love it. And I don't know about the other, Jerry Seinfeld and all that and Jay Leno and all those people. For some reason, those annoyed me, even John Stamos to some extent, even though that was kind of funny. But mm-hmm. It didn't bother me that Clint Eastwood was in his ad, even if he was one of the many celebrities, because he's sort of an icon. And as I said in my review, if Detroit had a voice and a face, it would be his. So grizzled and but wonderful and loved. And I love him, and I love the ad.
All right. We have to go to the halftime show. Madonna coming in, as Cleopatra, blaze of glory. Let's have a quick listen to that. So reviews have really been mixed for this one. Eric Deggans, was it a score or a fumble, do you think?
I thought it was the world's best karaoke competition ever. You hear that? The audio sounded like the record. Yeah. I mean, she wasn't really singing. The staging was amazing. The visuals were amazing. What I thought was the most interesting thing was that the rapper, M.I.A., totally stole Madonna's thunder by flipping off the audience briefly during her performance. And everybody has been talking about that and NBC's apology and NBC sort of blaming the NFL for producing the show and the NFL saying, well, NBC was slow in blurring out the image. Everybody's talking about that. And not so many people are talking about Madonna's wonderful performance, athletic performance as a 53-year-old who can still do cartwheels.
Really? Not so many people? I seem to hear something about that. What do you think, Makisha? Did she really moved? I saw that on Facebook, too.
She really moved, and then it looked like right before the end that she was tired. She looked like she needed a Gatorade. She needed a big Gatorade.
Okay. Vogue.
And she was like, ooh, girl. If I get MIA, somebody relieve me. I need to sit down.
If I get to say anything about that, the puff of smoke thing at the end where she just disappears, I have to say I kind of laughed.
Yeah.
Because she passed out. That's why they probably put
You didn't see that little stretcher, running exactly. out from behind. I give it up. It was wonderful, but I am mm-hmm. really getting tired of Super Bowl halftime performers who don't sing. Prince and Bruce Springsteen and Tom Petty and The Who all proved that you can go onto that arena, you can sing and perform live, and you can be amazing. So why not do it? I wanted to see, dancers gyrating to a pre-recorded track, I would put in an old Solid Gold episode.
Maybe next year. We have to wrap it up ourselves. Eric Deggans is the TV and media critic for the Tampa Bay Times, and he joined us from their newsroom. And Makisha Madden-Toby, TV critic and entertainment writer for the Detroit News, and she joined us from NPR's Bureau in Culver City, California. And thank you both for your time.
Thank you, Jackie.
And we stay on the topic of football for this next story. But instead of blockbuster ads and multi-million-dollar stadiums, we're looking at the less glamorous side of the game and perhaps one just as more compelling. Jamie King played football in high school and for a semi-pro league for 3 years, but his NFL dreams never exactly took off. He got his second chance when he was asked to coach a little-known team in a little-known league, the Fredericksburg Generals in Virginia. King recruited among men like himself, men with unfulfilled athletic dreams who had a lot to prove. But King even got a former NFL MVP to join the effort. And the story of how Jamie King pulled them together and this team in the mid-90s and turned them into champions is the cover story in this week's Washington Post magazine. It's called The General's Last Charge, and Jamie King joins me now in our Washington studios. Welcome to the program, Jamie King.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's an honor to be here, and I appreciate you guys having us on, and it's exciting to talk about what happened so many years ago, and it's still relevant, and people still enjoy the story. So
it is a really good story, and we'll get to it in just a second. But I do want to say, Jamie, for people not familiar with the team, who are the Fredericksburg Generals, and tell us even about this league. Perhaps some people don't even know about it.
Well, the league is called the Mason-Dixon League is based actually in Richmond, but the entire league is called the American Football Association with over 500 teams in the nation. And we were based in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and Fredericksburg Generals formed in 1994, and we had an incredible run shortly thereafter.
And let's just sidestep for a moment. This piece begins with you as a child watching your beloved Redskins and a father who was abusive, and he told you you weren't going to amount to anything. How did football help you get through this?
Well, I think football is a common denominator for a lot of things in life, especially you know, believing in yourself and able to dig through some tough times and just continue to battle. You're going to have ups and downs and everything in sports. And fortunately, I was able to kind of fortify myself within the sports world and kind of give myself something to believe in. And this team definitely helped me with that.
And a lot of your players were men who, like yourself, needed another chance. But one of the people that you got on was your favorite player, the place kicker Mark Moseley. Eventually, you got him to sign up with your team, and he was 47. Tell me how that happened.
Well, like I say, it was pretty remarkable. Mark, I'd known him, actually watched him as a young guy and admired him as just a fan, like most Redskin fans, and then was able to meet him, and he came to a couple of football camps, got to know him a little bit, and then I invited him down to help us with the team, and he was kicking pretty good, and I said, hey, we need help, and would you consider it? And it took quite a bit of prodding, but he came on, and it was just an amazing thing at 47 years of age to work with guys half his age in some cases and to provide the leadership that he did and all of the things that he provided for us outside of football. It was just an amazing thing and came at a great time in his life and was very big for us in the community.
Well, he needed you as much as you needed him.
I didn't know. I knew that he'd been going through some tough personal things and a lot of people didn't. He confided some things in me, and I know he'd been having some tough things going his life, and this team really helped him get a resurgence in his life and have a bright future, and we were excited about that. And it all worked out with him in the lineup. We were 20-0. We never lost a game.
It makes me think of a play. You had two championship seasons.
Yes, ma'am.
1995
and 96.
And after that, why did you all disband?
Well, you know, once you've climbed the mountaintop and you've done everything, the view is very as beautiful as it gets. And so many of those guys, I think, had fulfilled everything they wanted to and basically said, hey, we're going to go out on top, and they walked away from it. But it was an incredible group of guys and an incredible accomplishment that we achieved.
Jamie King, what are you doing today? What do you think is the lesson? This all happened more than a decade ago, but there's something kind of timeless about it. What's everyone doing now?
Well, as far as lessons, I mean, for me personally, there's a lot of kids out there that have dealt with abuse, whether it be physical and verbal and so forth, and one thing I hope from our story, that my story in particular, that they learn is, you know, never give up on yourself, never give up on your future, that there is going to be a brighter day if you believe in yourself. And one thing I like to tell parents out there is, you know, for step-parents, yeah, I admire the ones that do it the right way. And it's not an easy thing to take families on that in some cases you never knew about. And for parents that do it the right way, the regular parents, I admire them more than anything to see parents and the sacrifices they make. Sometimes, as I tell kids all the time, if you've got two great parents or one great parent in your life, really be proud of that and make sure you tell them.
Jamie King is the former coach of the Mason-Dixon League team, the Fredericksburg Generals. He's now the owner of the King Management Group, a sports management company. And thank you so much for joining us in our studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Jackie Leighton, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away today. It's Black History Month, and this year we're observing it by digging into some of the literature that's expanded the African-American story, the memoir. African-American memoirs date as far back as the journals set down by former slaves, and these days there seems to be even more of a zeal to set out one's family history or tell a compelling personal story. So every week throughout Black History Month, we're digging into a new memoir, too, and first on our list today is someone who's very clear that buying his book is exactly what you should be doing to celebrate Black History Month. Yep, he goes right there, and if you know his work, you anticipated that. Michelle Martin was joined earlier by Baratunde Thurston. He's the digital director of the satirical newspaper The Onion and one of the co-founders of the blog Jack and Jill Politics. His new book is called How to Be Black.
Thank you for joining
us.
It's
good to be back. Happy Black History Month. I'm black, y'all. It's a good week to be black.
Week of the month now. you know, I don't want to take anything for granted. So
okay.
Let's just, I'm going to be grateful for the moments that we have.
Well, you know, you mentioned in the book's intro that you want to recomplicate blackness. So you think it's not complicated enough now?
I think blackness itself is very complicated. I think some of the images of blackness are quite oversimplified.
You know, this book is funny, but it's also, it's heartbreaking in parts.
Mm.
Was there any pain point that didn't make it into the book?
No, in fact, there wasn't much cut from the book. I'll tell you, one of the things a lot of people don't know about the evolution of this book, it started as full satire. And on my email list, I make a deal with my subscribers. I say, look, I'm going to give you a true story for every email I send. And I was writing these personal stories, not for the book, but my initial editor at Harper said, you have to put these in the book. And I had written a story about my father and his murder, which I never had told before publicly. It was an exclusive to this email group, and I got the most response back from individuals and from the publishers saying, we have to rethink where you're going with this. We think we can find a way to fit this in. And so I went back, and the book became much more personal and memoir-based after that initial set of emails I sent out.
Well, let me just give the broad outlines for people who aren't familiar with you or with your work. Born in D.C., to a mom who was single for a lot of the time of your growing up,
yep.
In a neighborhood that, you know, your mom was actually interviewed in the paper for how the extraordinary efforts that she went to keep you safe.
That's right.
In this neighborhood at the height of the crack wars.
Yeah, the Washington Post did this big profile on trying to raise black men
and
in this environment.
You go on to one of the most prestigious K-12 schools in the city, Sidwell Friends School, which Chelsea Clinton attended, which the Obama girls now attend.
Notably, Chelsea went after I started going. I'm just going to put that out there. Maybe
so
I
So you
led
weren't
the
following
way.
Her. I get it.
I'm saying maybe
and then
she
you
was
went
following
to Harvard.
Me. Maybe she was following
Then you
me.
Went to Harvard, and you've been on all these lists, and you're of one of the kind of the creatives of your generation. So you've made quite a big name for yourself as a thinker, as a writer.
Thank you.
And here this memoir comes, and it's kind of like jazz.
Hmm. Wow. No one said that. Thank you. That's a beautiful word, and it kind of captures what I felt in the writing, which is this range, this up and down, the pace changes throughout, but I also hoped it still felt like one book and one story at the end of it.
And it's an instructional manual, too, if anyone's interested. So I'm going to ask you to read from the chapter, How to Speak for All Black People.
Absolutely. This is in the very middle of the book, and it's actually one of the first that I ended up writing. My own experiences as the black friend were merely training exercises for a much larger role. In the classroom, workplace, and beyond, once you're known as someone who is willing to talk about race, you become an official spokesperson for your race. Often, your willingness isn't actually required. Your mere standing as a member of the group in question is taken as qualification enough. Many a black person has been blindsided by the, what do you think about insert potentially black-related topic here question. Not thinking about the consequences, the non-black person asking simply reaches for the closest representative he or she can find. But for those unprepared for the call of duty, it can be a traumatic experience, leading to episodes of self-doubt, anger, and dry skin. Where this demand for black spokespeople is acute, however, is in the media. As a blogger, public speaker, and black person who writes books with the word black in the title, I've had my fair share of media exposure playing some version of the black spokesperson game. There's usually some kind of blackness emergency in which the cable networks light up a black version of the bat signal, hailing any and all potentially credible voices to offer perspective. Sometimes that beam is directed toward me, but unlike Batman, I don't feel the need to respond to every hail.
Black man. So that part isn't in the book. You have to.
That's the audio mix.
You have the audio mix. So who are you calling out here? Anybody in particular that you're calling out here?
You know, it depends on which side of the call you're talking about. I think in part I am calling out a media and business model that is shifting and thankfully fading. I'm calling out an era which we all recognize but hopefully see less of, which says we have to get a reverend to talk about everything related to black folks. We have to desperately comment on things that we don't understand to merely say that we've commented on them. And I think what we have started to see now, and I put myself in this category both as the object of my own satire, but also possibly as a generation of that's part of the solution, which is you have this blogger world, you have this new media world, you have these new voices emerging, and that recomplication of the image of blackness, if not blackness itself, can happen a little bit more because you have more people putting their identities, perspectives, and ideas out there.
What do you hope to accomplish with this book, besides to have fun? And the story of how it started with tweets actually is actually very, very hilarious. It started with a bottle of wine called Negro Amaro.
Yes.
Or is it Negro Amaro?
Negro Amaro.
Negro Amaro. Is that Portuguese? That sounds like a Portuguese red.
That's how
Spanish.
Little I knew about it. All I knew, ladies
you
and gentlemen.
Said, that's how black I am.
That's so. There was a I was trying to buy some wine. I didn't know anything about wine. I didn't want to learn about wine. I just wanted to buy it. I needed a way to make this decision. And I saw something with the word Negro in it, and I took it as a sign from Black Jesus that I was supposed to buy this bottle of wine. And so I did. And then I tweeted at my friend Elon James White, who's a comedian who's heavily featured in the book. And I challenged his blackness publicly, essentially, and said, how black are you? I bought wine because it had the word Negro in it. And that was
that's
the spiral
how black
that
I am. And
helped.
He says, challenge, son.
Exactly.
And there it goes.
So that's how some of this this
some
book
of this
got
stuff
born.
Started. But yeah. But what do you hope to accomplish with the book?
Well, I'd like to sell a lot of books.
Will you make that clear?
That would be great. But well beyond that, I mean, one of the things is to understand what it's not. I don't want this book to feel like the last chapter, like this is my last will and testament. This is some sort of final moment. Hopefully it's the beginning. Hopefully it's a party that everybody's invited to. And I want people to talk about it. I think we're at a fun and interesting and dynamic moment in the history of people. I can shout from the mountaintops who I am, and others can hear me and have the option to respect that. Serfs didn't have that. Slaves didn't have that. From the 1940s prior, no one had that. Essentially, we worked, we died very young with rotten teeth, and that was it. So what I think we have a great opportunity to do is to close that gap between who we really are and who the world expects us to be. And I also just hope that the humor makes it a little bit more accessible. This topic can be so tense and no one ever wants to even approach it that maybe this could open the door to some people who were closed to it before.
You know, I wanted to ask you about the humor because yeah. I have friends, acquaintances who are African-American, particularly men, who yeah. will never be photographed smiling because they feel that they have to be
hard.
Perceived as hard
yeah.
or serious.
They would find themselves at home in the chapter, How to Be the Angry Negro.
But your author photo, you're smiling.
Yeah.
There's humor throughout. And I just wanted to ask you about whether the humor is itself political.
It absolutely is. I mean, I'm political. So the things I do are, I'm a humoristic, that is not a word. I'm a humorous person and very well educated, obviously, because I can just make up my own words. And so those two things are constantly at play. But humor is a powerful medium to communicate, to engage, to reach people who would not be reached. I've been doing even more study into the sort of history of humor and satire in particular. And I found this great quote from Horace way back in the day. And I'm going to butcher it. But essentially, he says, he who badgers less can convince more. And, you know, that's not to say that badgering doesn't have a place. You need people in all angles of attack and change. But for me, this works. So the smiling, I'm a happy dude. Why wouldn't I be?
Because you had to navigate some tough, I don't know.
But the navigation led to the happiness, you know, and the pulling through it with the community around me. I also think it's very important people really understand this. I am not on a pedestal preaching like I did all this. I think I had some genetic talent. I clearly had an incredible mother. I have an incredible older sister who's had my back. And I had a community of infrastructure around us, the DC Youth Orchestra Program, the Boy Scouts. I was in an all-black Boy Scout group. All these were part of the infrastructure that kind of helped me. So I'm super happy because I've been helped as well and have kind of seen and navigated this crazy journey.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Baratunde Thurston. He is a comedian. He's digital director of the satirical newspaper The Onion. He's the author of a new memoir called How to Be Black. And just to remind, every week during Black History Month, we are joined by someone who has penned a memoir. Why was this the right time for this book, in your opinion?
Ooh, I think for me it was I had matured enough myself as a writer to be able to pull off something like this. And I think politically where the country is, I think the Obama moment has been
you have a
very
Nigerian
good
name.
One. And I have a
how
Nigerian
excellent
name.
Is that?
It was written, Michelle. It was written.
you too could be president. Or maybe not.
Slow down.
Or maybe not. But, you know, I do want to lift up something in the book, because you also talk about the very interesting reactions that different people have, or different audiences, maybe I could put it that way, have to your name. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, my name is Baratunde, which is derived from Babatunde, which is a very common name in Nigeria. My people, so far as I know, are not Nigerian. So enter the first hurdle. When I meet Nigerians, it's a great moment. Because there's this instant flash of recognition, then confusion, and usually irritation, annoyance, or anger. Because they're just like, what do you mean Baratunde? You mean Babatunde. Then they try to tell me what my name actually is. I'm like, well, I got a birth certificate that says it's this. And they're like, well, no, there's something wrong with your name. Meanwhile, you know, I've met various types of white people who are just like ecstatic. They're like, what does it mean? Does it mean the drummer on the tops of the mountains? And, you know, it's got to have some deep tribal essence to it. And it actually kind of does, right? It means one who was chosen. That's the colloquial translation of it. And then you have a lot of other black people like, Baratunde, that's normal. My name is, you know, this hybrid between a car and a bottle of wine, you know, like. So we have so much uniqueness already in the subset of African-American culture that it doesn't really shock.
But doesn't that imply that there's a constant judging? I mean, that is a part of the sub theme of the book is a constant judging of who is black enough. What does that mean to be black enough? I just want to ask you a question that one of my colleagues, a host in another program in another city, just recently asked me, who is white. He said, are you surprised that there's still this judging about what it means to be black, what it's supposed to mean, who's allowed to do what?
I'm not surprised. One, we're programmed to judge people. We have pattern recognition. So we are constantly trying to overcome our biology with civilization and culture and manners. So I'm not surprised at that base human level. I hope that we're moving beyond some of the rougher edges around that and just getting more nuanced with it, because we should have more models at our disposal to be less shocked.
But you also lift up something in the book, which I want to spend just a minute on, which I found fascinating. And this is something that other people, that people have been known to ridicule. But I assume you're being serious in the humor.
Uh-oh.
The importance of being the black friend.
Yes.
You say that there is a value to this and that you want to lift that up. Talk a little bit about that.
There's absolutely a value. And I think we have publicly, at least, assumed the value accrues to the white group of friends. It's like, oh, these white people have a black friend. Good for them. They feel more progressive or hipper by extension. But the black community and both communities get a lot out of that exchange. If we just retreat to our own existing assumptions, it's more difficult to grow. And so having an actual peer-to-peer relationship, again, softens the prejudgments. You may end up with judgments anyway, but at least they're based on an experience you had, rather than things you may have heard or may have read or cues you picked up from a mainstream media society, which is not fully respectful of the range of individuality.
But why do you even have to defend that? I mean, isn't that integration? Isn't that what integration was supposed to be about, which is that people would meet people who are different from them? We'd all be better. Why do you even have to defend that?
You don't have to defend it. You could just let it go. But I think you have, when charges are sort of levied at people that say, oh, because you're a black person who's hanging out with that group, you're this label, you're an Oreo or a sellout. That judgment is what you're combating, not just the act itself. The act itself doesn't require defense. It's human to want to connect with people. So I think that is okay. I also think we're hopefully at the younger levels too. These barriers are getting more porous. Kids all over the world rocking out to hip hop and breakdancing, and there's a global culture at a youth level that's emerging that's allowing kids to talk to one another across previously thicker lines. And that's, I think, a good sign for the future.
Well, before I let you go, do you have any tips for me on how to be black? Just polish me up a little bit.
So there's, the book closes on a plan for the future. That's called The Future of Blackness. I propose kind of a grand unified theory of blackness. And some elements of that I think you could benefit from, and maybe everyone listening. One, we've had this assumption that the people who are oppressed are supposed to fight the system of oppression, which makes sense. It's in their primary interest, but it's also in society's interest. And so what I'd love you to do is kind of find one of your white friends and officially designate that it's now their job to fix racism. And you could have a ceremony. You could hand over a baton on the front porch
just
or in the church or
a little
or a park.
Pass off.
Just an actual symbolic but substantive gesture that says, hey, why don't you lend a hand to this?
And then what do I get to do? What do I do?
Well, then you get to chill a little bit. You could work on one of the ideas that came out in the book in a conversation with Jaquetta Zatmari, a comedian friend, was, you know, intra-cultural exchange within black communities. She's like, I'm rural. I don't understand. People in Chicago and L.A., they talk a whole different language. So we're going to work on a Negretta Stone app that allows black people to communicate within one another and really try to build that up a little bit. So maybe you could work on that in your newly liberated time.
Well, thank you. You freed up some time. Yeah. I was actually going to take a nap.
Baratunde Thurston is the author of How to Be Black. He's also a comedian and the digital director of The Onion. And he was nice enough to join Michelle here in our Washington studio. As it takes two eyes to make a pair. Brother, we can't quit until we get our share. That's our program for today. I'm Jackie Leiden, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Tune in for more talk tomorrow. To do things for ourselves.